Hello and welcome to the podcast of moralapologetics.com. I'm your host, Jonathan Pruitt. I'm glad you're here. As always, our aim is to get you thinking about the moral argument because it has the ability to both illuminate the mind and stir the heart. This week on the podcast, we are continuing a discussion with Dr. Brian Scalise. Dr. Scalise has written his dissertation on the different views of God, Christianity, and Islam. Important differences for our view of love and ethics follow from the different views of God in each religion. When we build a worldview from the notion that God is absolutely one with no distinction, as in Islam, we get a deficient ethic and a deficient view of love. The Christian Trinity, on the other hand, provides a robust foundation for a substantive morality and understanding of love. Since God is one nature with three persons, it turns out that God essentially loves others. And it is this key difference that we will be exploring this week. Dr. Scalise will help us see this difference by pointing out that the highest command in Christianity is to love the Lord, while in Islam the highest command is to submit to Allah. We'll also touch briefly on Islam and the youth front dilemma. With that in mind, we'll head back over to Dr. Scalise's home here in Lynchburg and continue the conversation.
Well, we're just talking about Jesus' command to love your neighbor as yourself.
Right, right. And we were discussing how that there's some interesting implications that statement might have.
Yeah, I think so. And it is fascinating, and hopefully we can come back to this as well, that Paul will actually cite this, that command, as a summarization of the whole law. And we really need to kind of think about that, because that troubled me for a long time as a young Christian. It's like, well, no, the first greatest commandment should be the summary of the whole law, not the second. Why does Paul cite, it's comfortable to cite the second as a summarization?
So the first commandment is to love the Lord your God by your heart, soul, right. Mind, strength. The second one is to love your neighbor as yourself.
And Paul cites that. Second one is a summarization of the whole law.
Yeah.
And you go, Paul, you made a big mistake here because you missed something. So hopefully we can come back to that here at the end. But before we get there, I guess I've always found it fascinating that you shall love your neighbor as yourself probably is a bit relative if you don't connect it to the first greatest commandment. I don't know. I mean, because there is a danger. There's a danger that you put the emphasis on as myself.
Right.
If you emphasize that, let's say we put that in italics, we emphasize that as myself, and we go into this meditation type thing where I'm thinking about what I like done to myself and so forth, and then I act to ensure that act in such a way to others that I would want done to me, it can almost be turned into this kind of self-serving selfishness type of thing. Because all of a sudden, the whole reason why you're acting in such ways to certain other people is because really it's you want, not because you desire to give. And so I think the second greatest commandment always has to be tied to the first. And to be honest, the second greatest commandment, you can make that mistake of emphasizing the second one. And in the Islamic view, I don't know that that would be problematic.
Right.
Because, well, Allah clearly was alone, and so this thinking about how to love yourself would be proper and right.
Right.
Whereas on the Christian Trinitarian view, if we're you would say, well, no, loving others, like the Father has always loved the Son and the Son has always loved the Spirit, is always about this focus on another rather than this focus on self.
So in Islam, if I want to emulate God, which in Christianity we take to be the highest good you could do, is to appropriately imitate God.
Right.
On Islam, then, if we imitate God, we're going to end up only loving ourselves.
Yeah, there's a sense in which, and again, that comes down, and this is one of those internal difficulties for Islam, because you got the Quran that's telling you to love others.
Right.
But then you've got this vision, your theology proper that you're attributing to God that says, well, the way God loves is in a self-centered sort of way, so I should do the same thing.
And then there's this puzzle, too, I think, of, well, if you say that you should love others, then you have this moral good, a morally good thing to do that God could not do, sans creation. And it seems to make a deficient view of God at that point.
Yeah, I think that tends to degrade it.
So. Yeah.
Let me give a little bit of... Okay, so we've kind of taken a look at the second greatest command, and we've tried to get a little bit of explanation here for why, on the Islamic view, maybe that focus on yourself, what you want, and then you kind of turn the other part of the command, do unto others.
Yeah.
You turn that as a means to gain what you want. That's a very dangerous thing that can happen, especially if you believe that the most beautiful or proper form of love is a self-focused love.
Right.
If you believe that, that could easily happen. Whereas I'm saying on the Trinity, probably not so much. So I want to do a little bit of a kind of a exploration here with the Trinity, with the first greatest commandment. And I want to compare that with how God commands us to love. So
I got it. Just before you do that, real quick question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Is there a greatest commandment for Muslims?
Yeah, probably the Shahada, which is the first pillar of Islam, right. And it just there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. That the first part of that actually is kind of like a summary of Surah 112,
mm-hmm.
And that is this affirmation and belief and trust in God's absolute tawhid, right, or oneness, and that God can't have a son. He neither begets nor is he begotten. That Surah 112 is considered by most Muslim scholars, theologians, imams, and so forth to be kind of the creed of Islam.
Okay.
So I would look.
So
there.
For the greatest commandment is to believe that God is one,
and that Muhammad was the seal of prophethood and the end all, okay, the telos, so to speak.
Right. Okay. All right. So back to what you're saying about.
All right. So sometimes, if you think of God as just one, you might say, well, the two greatest commandments are just a set of commands for creatures. They're not necessarily things God does. But if we have this view of God as Trinity, we would then say, no, this seems to be, the two greatest commands seems to be nothing than God inviting us to practice the very same thing that the Father, the Son, and the Spirit have done eternally together. So you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, and all your strength. Now, I don't want to get too technical here, but in Trinitarian theology, you can rationally justify that each individual person of the Trinity is God in himself.
Right.
It's called autotheos in traditional theology, and it's rationally justifiable. I don't have the time to go into that type of detail right now. But essentially what you have the Father, who's God in himself, loving the Son, who's God in himself, loving the Spirit, who's God in himself. So you shall love the Lord your God isn't something that just for creatures to do, but this is actually an extension. God saying, this is what's going on up here with us, mm-hmm. We love one another, and we're all God. So we invite you into that harmony, so to speak. So you guys do it, and then you'll relationally join in with us.
Right.
And then the same thing goes, so you shall love your neighbors yourself. Again, going back to the Trinity. Now, again, we have to kind of distance a little bit here, because obviously the way that the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, if we're going to use that term neighbor, the way that they're neighbors isn't the same way we're, because you and I are separate.
Right.
They're not separate, but there's still a sense in which is one anotherness. And that's an essential idea for a neighbor. Like, if I'm a good neighbor, I have a certain degree of one, I'm one another with my neighbor, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a good neighbor if I do that. So the same thing, the second greatest commands, again, seems to just be an extension of God saying, well, this is what's going on with us forever. Now you guys do it,
yeah,
with one another. So it's not some strange thing, but it's actually an echo, basically, of eternity that God's passing to us and asking us to join in.
Yeah, so Paul then, when he gives the second commandment, right, or the second greatest commandment as summing up the whole law.
I think on a Trinitarian view, that makes perfect sense. Because you shall love your neighbors, if we get kind of this analogy of Father, Son, Spirit, or neighbors, well, they're also God.
Right.
So the whole law can be love your neighbor yourself. Well, why? Well, because that's what God does. Oh, and that fulfills the first greatest commandment anyways. Because it's based on this premise that the Father and the Son love one another. So this whole idea of loving one another is a summary of the law. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, if I'm to love my neighbor properly, then I am to exalt the highest good by laboring on his behalf towards inviting him into that. So yeah, I think there's no problem there. I would certainly see that as inherently relational as well.
Yeah, so it seems like both the commands entail both of the first command to love the Lord your God, better heart, soul, and strength, and the command to love your neighbor as yourself. That both of those entail the other one.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah,
I think so. Especially on a Trinitarian view, we might run into a little difficulty if on an Islamic view, if God were just alone, all of a sudden all this, you know, one another stuff gets pretty hard to unpack.
Yeah. So I wonder what you make of this too. So it's interesting that on Christianity that the greatest commandment is a commandment to love God. And the second one is to love your neighbor and yourself. But on Islam, it's not about love. The primary right action that we're told to do is to assent to, or submit maybe would be a better word in the Islamic context, to God, that God is God, or that God, or what would even that
mean? Yeah, yeah, that's right, because, I mean, Islam itself is just, the word Muslim means a submitter, and Islam means submit.
Right.
So, yeah, it's about submission to God and affirming what God has done, rather than about loving God. And it's actually a fascinating thing, and Miroslav Volf unpacks this in his book a little bit with a discussion with some of the contemporary Muslim scholars and theologians. But most of them, the Sufis are a little different, but most Muslim theologians, like mainstream Sunni, are very uncomfortable with this whole idea, even of God loving. Like, that's a primary attribute. Mm-hmm. And so similarly, they're not okay with us calling him our father. So even that whole father-child idea is not really okay in Islam. So really, it's about worship and submission. It's not about, I guess, we had to create a stark contrast. Worship and submission in Islam, Christianity seems to be more about love and friendship. So they're both relational. It's just that the way that relationship is conceived,
mm-hmm.
one seems more hierarchical. And the other one seems, it still has this reverence in it, but it's more, I guess, invitational might be a good way to put it.
Well, you know, that's, so I think that bringing out this sort of fundamental ethical difference between an ethic of submission and an ethic of love, and maybe even enjoyment, maybe that works out on a large scale in terms of Islam, is that when the religion is, at least this is my understanding, you can correct me if I'm wrong, which is a very likely possibility, but that Islam would be practiced in the ideal circumstances would include the state, but the state would be Muslim state.
Yeah, that's correct. No, that's correct. I mean, Islam is a whole lifestyle. There's no area in which Islam does not influence or transform, and this is why in the socio-political arena, we're seeing such problems with that integration into westernized countries, because Islam doesn't compartmentalize. Christianity, we say, well, you got spiritual life over here, you got secular life. They say, no, everything is spiritual life. Everything has to submit to the Islamic way of life.
Right.
And that culture is inherently Arabic, because that's the original, that context in which it created, and the original Quran is written in Arabic, and all that's trying to play itself out.
Right, so I guess what I'm getting at is, are there any societal differences? I mean, so
yeah, I think in relation to the state, I mean, you got some pretty big difficulties here, and there's a guy named, can't remember his first name right off the bat, but he's considered the founder of radical Islam today. Yeah. His last name is Qutb, or Qutb, and he basically kind of lays out this fact that no human authority should be able to reign in the wake of Allah's authority, namely, he calls every human authority into question, including in his day, Islamic leaders of states. He called them into question. He was actually imprisoned and had a really tough life. But his books were one of the most highly read books out there. And so you kind of get into this issue where this idea that Allah is love, but this love is self-centered love, mm-hmm. and then you get into this fact that, well, their greatest commands focus more on submission to the religion of Islam or submission to Allah, rather than on this, like, Christianity is very much, our main purpose is to love others well, both God and self and others. So you get into this kind of difficulty where you say, it's almost an autocratic authoritarianism
mm-hmm.
that gets upheld as the greatest and best thing, because again, a sole entity alone who's focused on self-love, and all things need to come into submission to the one who loves himself and needs to serve that end. But he's solely alone. And so you do get a very hierarchical. So that's going to play itself out in all dimensions of authority. Because if any Muslims out there, and let's say he's a very religious one, he thinks about these theological ideas, I mean, that's going to, you know, sink its way down to your soul.
I think about even the relationship between men and women, right?
Well, certainly. Yeah, in the hardcore Islamic states, which I can't think of all, you know, Saudi Arabia, and there's a few others that are really hardcore about it, but certainly you do see that autocratic or authoritarian tendency where the man just has dominance. But again, why would dominance be bad? Because Allah is alone. It's not about relationality and eternity past. That's not the case. He's alone, and then when he creates, he's utterly alone as ruler, and everyone else is beneath him.
Yeah, so the ultimate ethic is not one of concern and care for others, but of submission. Even in terms of men, husband and wife.
Well, yeah, based on their theological view of God, certainly. And again, we run into, and we've got to be careful here, because the Quran's going to give commands, you know, okay, well, treat your women well, these type of things, right. But you're going to have that constant conflict. But the way God is, you know, if they think like we do, like, oh, we should mimic that.
Right.
Well, you got this huge problem because, submission's the goal and authority is the means.
Well, it also is a problem if you think God's not worth imitating, you know.
Well, they might be. So many Muslim scholars would say something like this, I think. I think I'm representing them well. The goal is to obey God's commands, not to question or try to be like him. But again, you know, where does his commands come from? Aren't they linked to his nature, you know? So you can kind of question there.
Yeah, that's a good question.
But notice the fact that authoritarianism we're talking about comes out in even the way that question is answered. Your job is to obey the commands, not question them.
Right.
Notice how authoritarian that is. Don't innovate. Don't sit here and have conversations like this. Very authoritarian. You know, you see this type of thing playing itself out in a lot of ways.
So one thing that brings to mind something of the Euthyphro dilemma, right? That, is the Muslim going to give a different answer to the Christian regarding the Euthyphro dilemma? You know, I know that there's different responses, but one of the Christian responses is to say that the right is determined by God's commands.
Correct. Right? By his will.
Right. But the good is determined by God himself, his nature. So that God always commands what is good. So all his commands are good. But what makes them right to do is that he commanded them, right? But we can have assurance that God is good and that his commands are good. But would the Muslim be able to say the same thing about Allah's commands, you think?
And again, it's kind of like in Christianity. You kind of have a spectrum here. But most of them are focused on the fact that what Allah commands creatures isn't necessarily linked to his nature. It's an expression of his will for humanity, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's expression of himself through his will for humanity. So that's a little bit more agnostic than what we're used to in Christianity, right? Because they're going to say, well, we can know his will, but that doesn't mean we necessarily know his... Now, not all of them are like that. Some are more on the end of, his will, what he commands and what he makes known of himself is who he is, and we can come to know him in that way. But I think... on the Euthyphro dilemma, if I understand the majority of Islam rightly, there would be
voluntarist
side of things, which would be that it's right because God wills it.
Right.
That's probably where they would be.
So, God could command things that aren't actually good.
According to our human intuitions, but I think the Muslim would say something, your intuitions are wrong.
But that's the point of the voluntarist position, though, is that God could command things that are not good.
Right.
But the commands make them right to do.
Right.
But that they're actually not good to do.
Yeah.
This gets back to this whole idea of God being one, or Allah being one, right? It seems like there's a moral deficiency in God, and that we,
Kind of bring that into the Euthyphro dilemma. Yeah. It's just that the Euthyphro dilemma, I don't even think that they would, like most Muslims probably wouldn't even think about it very much. It would just be, well, whatever Allah wills is what he wills.
Right.
And don't you question it. I mean, the whole dilemma, unless you go back to historic Muslim theologians who can actually kind of innovate and explore those things.
Right.
No, they won't even allow you to talk. They don't even talk about that.
Right.
They wouldn't even get into that.
It's not even a concern whether God is really good. I mean, his commands are good. It's just that he commanded him, so you got to do them. That's the end of it.
Yeah, I think they might focus more on the idea of trust.
Okay.
We can trust God.
Yeah, but see, then I'm coming back to this idea, but why? Why is God worthy of our trust, though?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And then you come back to,
because he commands
it. Because he commands it, because he's the authority, you know.
Right.
Right.
Well, and you see this perpetuated constantly. I mean, I've been watching a lot of these debates lately, and some of these Christian theologians and Islamic apologists, and you do just kind of see this raw adherence to what the Quran says about the Trinity. And it's amazing because the Quran statements about the Trinity, there's only one place where it really looks like it defines, and it says that has Allah talking to Jesus. Did I ever say to worship me, to worship God, me, and my mother?
Right.
And then another place it says, say, desist, Christians, it is better for you. Say no longer that Allah is the third of three. Now, the thing is that in historic Christianity, I have never been able to find any Christian at any time who's ever said that.
Right.
So you look at this and you go, they will not relent. They will say, this is what the Trinity is. And you say, I can't find one Christian ever who has ever said God is the third of three.
Right.
I've never found anyone.
Which, that would be tritheism.
Right. Well, yeah. Right. Well, maybe. It seems even more confused than that, because right. The whole language, God is the third. You might say the Father is the third of three, or the Son, but the whole idea, like, God is the third of three? What is that? Yeah, it would be
something more confusing.
Yeah, it's very confusing. So, but the thing is, they will not. So they're really fideists, and that makes really hard. Yeah, I watch these debates. It looks like they're just hardcore fideists to the scriptures.
Right.
Because they don't even. They won't. You know, and James White especially has been doing a lot of debates on this, and you just see him constantly be exacerbated because he'll say, well, let me define my own position. He'll constantly make this plea.
Right.
Let me define my own position. I am the Christian here. You don't tell me what I believe. Islamic apologists are just, no, this is what you think.
Right.
Because the Quran says so.
Yeah. And to bring that back again, why is it this way? Why is it that, these scholars are taking this position where it is not a position that necessarily has come about because of reflection and one's own study, but because God said in the Quran the Christians believe this, therefore that's what we believe, right?
Yeah, and historically, I mean, you'd have to do a pretty in-depth historical analysis to see this, but I can make one general comment about it. It looks to be the case that Christianity, in our history, it looks as though the great theological debates, because if you look, the first really 8 centuries of the church are nothing but hardcore theological debates.
Right.
And this only encouraged continual theological debate later. After the dark, you had the dark ages in there where who knows what's going on really. I mean, it's just kind of dark. But then you come to, you know, Aristotelian logic and Thomism and so forth, and then it kind of continues. So the questioning just leads to greater questioning, and we stand on their shoulders, and we still remain within these parameters of orthodoxy, but we continue to develop theology, mm-hmm. and that's where we're at today. Whereas in Islam, it looks like they had the same situation where you have these great theological debates going on,
mm-hmm.
but it's unlike, see, early Christianity is uncentralized. There's no centralized authority trying to control it. But Islam is very different. It's centralized from the very beginning. You have the caliphates really early on.
Right.
And so basically what looks to be the case is that they try to, they say to desist and to stop with the theological debating because it's disruptive for the caliphate and the living of life together and so forth. And you have a centralized authority that can ensure that those things stop. Whereas early Christianity, you don't have anyone that can do that.
Yeah.
Maybe by the time you get to Constantine, but even at this point, you have an Eastern and Western church. So even at that point, you don't have total control over everything.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I'm thinking again about this idea of submission as the primary ethical value versus love, love of another. And that seems to be consistent with that theme that, you know, even in our theological discourse, it becomes about submission to the caliphate, not about individuals, you know, reflecting and thinking about God and exploring what. Granted, we, you know, like you said, we need to be careful because I know that Islam has a great intellectual history,
mm-hmm.
So it we does. Don't want to diminish that. But there is that theme too of submission to the authority, right? I don't know. What do you think about that?
No, I think that's good. Maybe we can really try to bring this home by kind of giving this imagery. I think the Allah human relationship is really well seen by this idea of a king and someone bowing the knee.
Right.
I think that, and that's what we see Muslims do 5 times a day, sometimes more, as they bend their knee to worship and pray towards Mecca. Whereas I think we can kind of summarize, the Abba Father of the New Testament with a child reaching up to grab his father's neck. You know, so, and it's not to say that that child doesn't ever bend down and be reverential towards the father, but it is to say that that imagery of a father-child relationship and the reaching up to grab and enjoy in
the prodigal son, you know? Yeah. The old father running out to greet the son, you know? Right. That's a very powerful image.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. So I think you kind of have these two images, and you see that radical difference between submission and this warm, loving embrace. I think that there is a strong contrast there.
And it looks like that... So at least theoretically, if we were to think about how those ethics would bear out, we would think that a society or a community of people that took submission and authoritarianism as the primary virtue, it would be a society that we wouldn't really want to live in. It would be a society where our concerns and our needs as humans would be disregarded. And
I'm going to add a little caveat here, maybe humorously, but yeah. I wouldn't want to live in that society unless I was the one in power.
Right, yeah, exactly.
If I'm the authority and everyone else has to submit, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah, but on the other hand, if we have a worldview, a theology that where the primary virtue is love your neighbor as yourself, right? That's going to create a community or a society of people that, in general, is going to be a place where we want to live. I'd rather live among people who are motivated by love for others than submission to a certain authority, right?
Yeah. Yeah, because there's a certain amount of protection there, this idea that, the consideration of me being respected and considered is going to be one of the primary things they're concerned about. And it's actually interesting that the Ten Commandments kind of puts a little bit of meat on love your neighbor yourself. And it's interesting because it's like, you will not do this to your neighbor. You won't do this to your neighbor. You won't do this to your neighbor. So there's a bunch of these negatives that kind of play themselves out and say, all right, so you need to do good to your neighbor. And that doesn't include this negative list of things. So it really clarifies that relationship.
Yeah. And I think that another, just to kind of put another caveat here. This is not to say that Muslims are unloving or something like that. This is just to say that if we were trying to envision how a society would work based on these theological notions of who God is and the primary ethics of these theological systems, right?
Yeah. Let me say a word to this, because I think you're bringing up a really important point, because too often you'll say, oh, well, this is just theoretical stuff that's out there, whatever. And then, you know, I sit back and I think, well, I teach Greek classes at a major university, and I train pastors in the seminary that are going to go, now, do you think that I'm actually espousing my ideas? I might be simplifying some of the stuff I'm saying here, but I'm still espousing my ideas.
Right.
So, a lot of times people say, well, this isn't what the masses think. So, sure, maybe, you know, majority of masses of Muslims are loving. I have no problem saying that.
Right.
But it's the fact is that religious leaders study this stuff so that they can distribute those ideas.
Right.
So this idea that, you know, oh, that's just esoteric or out there stuff, or that doesn't ever come. No, it does come home, because I promise you, I'm delivering this stuff constantly in many of my conversations, different forms, but these ideas are getting disseminated.
Yeah. Well, I guess what I'm just trying to say is that I don't want people. We don't want to make prejudice statements.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I don't.
That's good.
And I wouldn't want. I'm sure that if you talk to a Muslim here in Lynchburg, that they're likely to be the nicest person you'd meet. You know, that's the only point there. But yeah, absolutely.
Well, I went to the mosque when I was writing my dissertation and talks, and they were. They were very hospitable, kind people.
But that you're absolutely right. You know, what we believe actually influences what we do.
Right. Yeah. So, because you do come across this attitude from time to time where it's like, well, that stuff doesn't really matter. And I always just think, well, it does. It's just that you're being influenced not knowing it.
Right.
You know, you
have some other worldview at play that, like, and I think this gets back to your point about what makes better sense of our experience. Right.
Yeah. And it's powerful, you know, because we all have experience.
That if we live in a way, if the Muslim woman, you know, a man living here in Lynchburg, lives in a way where they love others as ends and not just means, that what worldview makes more sense out of that than the fact that that seems like the right thing to do and the best thing to do?
Yeah, that was kind of the aim of my entire project, was to say, okay, let's not be prejudiced. Can Muslims love well? Absolutely. Right. They might even outperform the vast majority of Christians. Christians historically have said that from time to time.
Right.
That the Muslim, you know, communal ethics outperforms the Christian one that they experience. So that might totally be the case, but as you just said, which image of God or what vision of God makes better sense of that? And it's just my entire project that said the Trinity makes really great sense out of this reality that we experience these degrees of community or oneness. There's others around us, and there's relationships.
Right.
And that love exists in that sort of arena, whereas with Allah, well, he's just alone. It does very little to explain what I do every day of my life.
So if you want to have a worldview to make sense of love, you should be a Christian rather than a Muslim.
You would, no doubt, because you have this one another. I mean, just any mother of a child or any father of a son or daughter, I mean, you know, having the child there with you, at least I think if you have your, you know, your affections are working properly,
right,
that is better than not having them there. I mean, it's good. Like, it's one another. It's better to have this one another with my child than not,
right,
just to be alone. So hopefully that speaks to our day in, day out lives.
Right. And then I think that, so I want to draw one more line from this. You know, we've been talking about Islam the whole time, but I think, too, that the atheist worldview has a similar problem, you know, that they practice love, they know it's, if you're an atheist, you know it's good to treat others as ends, not merely as means, or to treat another person as a real human person of value and dignity and not just a pile of molecules arranged a certain way, right?
Right.
And that turns out that in that case, too, if you want to have a worldview that makes sense of that intuition of your experience, that you should adopt Christianity rather than atheism.
Well, you certainly would, because on atheism, you know, it used to be fashionable that they could say that the world was, you know, infinite or everlasting or what have you, which modern science has seemed to be disconfirming lately.
Right.
But whatever they could say, I mean, you still have this, okay, so you have just chaos, like molecules colliding, and then we happen to come about, well, this is no foundation for morality.
Right.
As Hume so put it so well, you can never derive an ought from an is.
Right.
And so, I mean, the fact that you have love at all, if you're an atheist, where in the world does that come from? It's not, how could you get that from just nature?
Well,
can I say one more word?
Yeah.
Just because I don't want to linger here long. Maybe we can do another session at another time if you want to kind of unpack this more. But I would point out that the Islamic Christian conversation about love has massive ramifications on the notion of the ends justifies the means. Mm-hmm. We've been using that language a lot.
Right.
But you got, you know, if a human is an end in themselves, then loving God is accomplished by loving that person well, right, on the Trinitarian view. Well, Islamic view, though, it would seem that the ends justifies the means. You use the person to love Allah. There seems to be a justification here of that ethic that we typically are really uncomfortable with, this mm-hmm. whole idea of using someone. And I think maybe, you ever think about a woman that's called a gold digger, you know, and I'm not trying to go after women here, but, mm-hmm. right, she marries a man for his money, and most yeah. of us are morally disgusted by this because we recognize that she's using the man as a means to get to his money, and that's an improper value system.
Right.
She shouldn't be doing that. So you kind of see this, but, well, maybe there isn't anything wrong with it. Maybe it's okay to use humans to get up to other means.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think there's a good question to kind of go after a little bit.
I want to thank Dr. Scalise for another insightful and productive podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and learned as much as I did. I also want to remind you that over at moralapologetics.com, we have content going up all the time from a wide array of scholars from different disciplines, from literary scholars to biblical theologians to philosophers. We have poetry going up. So if you get a chance, head over to the site, and I'm sure you'll find something that is both interesting and useful for you. And if you get a chance and you want to stay up to date with what's going on at the site, make sure to follow us on Twitter and to like us on Facebook. So thank you again for listening to this week's episode, and I hope to see you again next week.